Accession number 11105, Colonel M. McBain, Reel 20.
At this stage in Egypt, Colonel, were there any indications that problems were coming over the canal zone?
There were no indications of problems, certainly not at our level. But what did happen, and we were told that an agreement had been reached that the British were to leave the canal zone. I can't remember whether we in fact were given a date. It was of fairly academic interest to us because by this stage of the proceedings we knew when we were leaving, and that was the most important thing to us. The first signs of this agreement and the imminent change was when we started having contact with the Egyptian army, which we'd never had before, and we started having Egyptian officers in particular out on exercises with us, and I think they came to stay with us, I can't remember offhand, but certainly there were Egyptian army personnel moving around in the canal zone, which of course was a completely new departure. We were not particularly impressed, however, as I say, we weren't really worried because we were virtually on our way home. And in due course, we all went up to Port Said and got on a venerable old ship called the Lancashire, I think.
What time, kind of date would this be?
This would be probably late spring, early summer, 1955. And again, rather like the ship that took us out to Korea. This, I think, from memory, was a prize from the Germans after the First World War. It certainly was pretty ancient. It had three masts and I think three funnels. Anyway, it didn't worry us. It was moving, and off we went. On the way home, it was a pretty uneventful journey. We called into Malta, which was unusual. And for the life of me, I have no idea why we did, I can't think that it was at our request. But there had been Durham Light Infantry of some sort in Malta during the war, and as usual, it was quite impressive as we drove into the Grand Harbour. The bugles were up on the forecastle and they sounded, and of course that echoed all over the harbour. And from memory, we anchored in the Grand Harbour and a party went ashore and I think laid a wreath at a memorial. And then back on board and off we went again. And eventually arrived off Liverpool, where there were a lot of ships. And we wondered what that meant. And then we were very quickly told that, in fact, there was a dock strike, a national dock strike. And we had visions of being anchored off Liverpool until the dockers sorted themselves out. But, no. We were told that we were going to go in and we were going to have to unload the ship ourselves. And not only was there a dock strike, there was a rail strike. So in we went. And certainly I'd never been into Liverpool that way before. And we went up the river. And we'd been split into shifts and gangs to unload the ship. And I think we were wondering, well, if there's a dock strike, how do we get tied up? But somebody appeared, men appeared, and we were tied up. And as the ship tied up, it was really quite impressive. It must have been, I suppose, a squadron or company of RASC vehicles, brand new RASC vehicles, drove onto the quayside. And this was the transportation to take our baggage. And that really was quite impressive. They were brand new vehicles of a type we hadn't seen before. They became the stalwart of the army transport system for many years after that, but in 1955 they were new. And so off we went, and in fact, of course, the ship's officers said the ship had never been unloaded so quickly. And it all went off in these wagons.
This, in effect, was your return from Korea.
Oh, yes. Well, yes. Although that was 2 years ago. But yes, it was. 3 years before, roughly, we'd set off for Korea, and this was coming back. And then a fleet of coaches arrived, buses, and we got on those. I think it took us 2 days to unload the boat. And so half the battalion, I think, went on the first day and another half the second day. And we drove across to Barnard Castle, where the camp we had been allocated was not big enough for the battalion. So again, we must have been a fairly strong battalion. And my company, support company, was put into a camp with a gunner regiment. That was all right. We then all went off on leave and came back. And really the only thing, I'll conclude this little episode with, before we left Egypt, I had been told that my guns, my 6-17 pounders and the gun towers, had to be brought back to England. And so we had prepared them and in fact taken them up the road to Port Said, and they had gone on to a ship, a cargo ship, not the troop ship. And we got back and we went to Barnard Castle, we then went on leave, and we came back from leave. We were then told that the guns and the carriers were down in Tilbury or London docks. And please would we go and get them. And so off we went. And of course they had arrived during the dock strike, but it was quite clear that how it had happened we just don't know. It was quite clear that those vehicles had been driven round London docks by the dockers. Where they got the fuel from I don't know, because they were thirsty beasts. And they're obviously empty for shipping, but they'd been driven, and they were bashed about a bit, so far as you can bash an armoured vehicle, a tank, but the mudguards and things like that were bashed. The guns were all right, except they all had punctures, and there they were, looking very sad on the dock side. And they were put on a train and arrived duly in Barnard Castle Station, which was still functioning, of course, in those days. And we drove them solemnly from Barnard Castle Station down to the camp, all in their bright yellow livery. I had, while we were still in Egypt, been on a course at the School of Infantry Support Weapons Wing to be trained to learn about the new battalion anti-tank weapon, the BAT, battalion anti-tank weapon, that's how it got its name, which was the first British Army recoilless weapon. And that is what we were re-equipped with in Barnard Castle, having spent a lot of time and effort chipping yellow paint off all the old stuff, painting it green and getting rid of it. We were then re-equipped with a BAT.
Was it an improvement on the 17-pounder?
Yes, I mean it was in fact a more effective weapon, although it was never tested in action, whereas of course the 17-pounder had been. But yeah, I mean it was 120mm. It was a big shell with modern explosive techniques, and it would have destroyed any tank at that time. Probably in fact made a dent still today. But to the old 17-pounder men, of whom Smudger Smith was died in the war. It wasn't a proper gun. It was a strange weapon. And old Smudger, he never really came to terms with it at all. But it was a very effective weapon. But like all new weapons, it had its problems, particularly with the ammunition. However, we were re-equipped with that. That, in due course, was then succeeded by Mobats and Wombats and Dingbats and various other bats before missiles came in. But it was never, to my knowledge, ever used in anger. Not that I know. I then left the battalion, having volunteered for service in Malaya. Before I went to Malaya, I got married. And
any reason why you wanted to leave the battalion?
Well, I'd been with them for 5 years. 5 years. And it was fairly normal at that stage in the army's development for officers, having done 5 years, to go away from the battalion because you'd been a platoon commander all that time, unless something unusual had happened. You might have been a signals officer or an adjutant, but you'd probably just been a platoon commander. And so there wasn't a lot of scope for development, really, I suppose. You could have stayed there. And eventually, I suppose, would have become a company second in command or something like that. But it would have been a fairly narrow existence. And so, as I say, most people tended to go away to do something, either colonial service or, increasingly common, was learning to fly in the Army Air Corps. But it was some secondment like that. I mean, some people went off to the parachute regiment on secondment, because that, in those days, this parachute regiment was not a permanent cadre. You did a 3-year tour with them and then went back to your own regiment. So I'd say it was a normal career move. I chose Malaya because what I'd seen of the Far East, I thought it was an interesting part of the world. And so off we went for 3 years. And
where did you move? Which regiment did you move into?
Well, I went into the Malay regiment. I was on contract, I suppose. Yeah, I was on contract seconded to the Malay regiment. And I went to the 1st Battalion, Malay regiment, for 3 years. And I did.
What date was this?
This was February 56. And I did 18 months as a platoon commander on operations in the jungle against the communist terrorists. And the last 18 months as adjutant of the battalion. And that, of course, covered the period of Malayan independence. They got their independence in 58. 57, when it became the Royal Malay Regiment, the Royal being the Malay Royal, not the British Royal.
Did you see any, or experience any actions in the jungle?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Yes, I was lucky because, I mean, there were a lot of people out there, because this was the tail end, really, of the emergency. And the terrorists, in fact, were moving north all the time back to their firm bases, their secure bases in South Siam, South Thailand. And there were fairly persistent sort of peace meetings and conferences and so on. They had effectively been beaten, but they were still around and it was our job to find them and so on, but they were a fairly rare species. And I mean, people would pound the jungle for 3 years, never see a soul. which was very disheartening. But I in fact had two contacts, which reduced the number of terrorists a little bit. So I was lucky in that way. Again, an interesting facet of the British way of operating as opposed to the American way of operating, subsequently in Vietnam, because the two situations were very similar. The British Army was always acting in support of the civil power, and we were under civil jurisdiction. And if anyone killed a terrorist, you were charged with murder. And you then, in fact, it was switched to culpable homicide. But I, as the responsible person, I had to go to the magistrate's court and great forms and papers to fill in and all the rest of it, to establish that, in fact, all I'd been doing was doing my job. But that was the crux of the thing. I had to go to a magistrate and tell him that. Now, and the Americans, of course, in Vietnam, there was no military or no civilian authority at all, and they just took it as a straight military operation. Ours was a straight military operation, but we were responsible, ultimately, to the civil authorities, whereas the Americans were responsible only to the military authorities. So that was the difference. The general officer commanding in Malaya was responsible to the British High Commissioner before independence. He wasn't the boss. So that was a very fundamental difference, and that was why we won in Malaya eventually, and why the Americans lost in Vietnam. It's as simple as that. There were other factors, obviously, but that was a fundamental difference in the way we operated.
What was the crux of the operation, the basic elements?
It was search and destroy operations, trying to find these terrorists. Latterly, after I'd come out of the jungle and when I was adjutant, the emphasis changed to try to get the terrorists to surrender and bring them out, because, you know, everyone was finding it a bit soul-destroying. They wanted to come out, but they didn't know how to. Or they wanted to get up into Thailand, didn't know how to get there. And so it really was a bit of a stalemate. They were not operating as terrorists other than at a very local level. Obviously, if they wanted food or clothes or boots or anything, yeah, they would go to a village and say, give us whatever they wanted or we'll kill you. But they weren't ambushing civilians or British people or troops or anything like that. It was sort of defensive terrorism, if there is such a thing. They were merely trying to survive. And so it was clear they'd given half a chance by this stage, if the conditions were right, they would come out. And there were, I know I wasn't involved, but there were some very brave people, policemen mainly, British and Malay, who would go in and persuade them to come out. There was financial reward, and again, you know, it's a little side passage in interest that, of course, he'd been a Chinese communist terrorist, but you offer him a few dollars, and within months he was a great roaring capitalist running a little shop somewhere. But that's life. And so that was towards the end of my stay there, when they were being encouraged to surrender. And it sounds easy, but in fact it's not an easy operation, because both sides quite naturally were a bit suspicious of the whole thing. And as I say, there were a lot of brave people who went in to the jungle and persuaded these guys to come out. take them away, and they were debriefed, and then there was a financial reward given to them to set them up.
What was your Malay soldiers like?
They were okay. They'd been at this, of course, since it had started in 1948, on and off, and there were, because it was a volunteer, all-regular army, there were a lot of the older soldiers who'd been at it since then. Indeed, the very senior ranks, I mean, the regimental sergeant major, was a pre-war Malay regiment soldier and had been captured by the Japanese in Singapore. He was a lovely old man. And the Malay soldiers were fine. They were well used to jungle operations. They were not the most aggressive soldiers, but in any given organisation, military organisation, there's always a percentage of soldiers who won't go when you want them to go, for various reasons. The only thing I would say about the Malays was there's probably a slightly higher percentage there than in the British Army. Having said that, the two contacts I had, they were fine, and we did what we had to. But yeah, there were some who were taking cover behind trees and so on. Well, that's all right. As long as I had enough to do what was necessary. But they were a happy, cheerful lot, and that made a big difference. Once they got to know you, and you got to know them, and there was mutual trust, and that made a big difference, because plodging around the jungle for, you used to go in for 10 days, you'd go in with 5 days' rations and take an airdrop in the middle, if you were lucky, and then come out after the second 5 days. It's a bit tedious, but the Malays, as I say, were always cheerful, normally cheerful. And they're always good for a laugh, you know. They'd wait for the British officer to fall off. If you were crossing a little stream on a fallen down tree, they'd always send you across first and wait for you to fall in the stream and all sit on the banks roaring with laughter. Or if you were climbing a steep hill in the pouring rain, the mud and the clout with about 80 pounds on your back, they'd wait for you to slip, and they'd stand back and just watch you slide all the way down to the bottom of the hill again laughing like drains. Well, okay, fine. No, I enjoyed it. It was a change, it confirmed my thoughts that the Far East was an important, very important part of the world, and that's been shown subsequently, and still is. Came home from Malaya, and then was adjutant, and came back. I had, I think, the longest leave I've ever had. I think it was 2.5 months I was entitled to when I came back. And then rejoined the Durham Light Infantry as adjutant of the 8th Battalion, the TA Battalion in Durham. And had 2 very happy years there, living in Brunsworth and working in the old drill hall at the top of Claypath. And then 1961, rejoined the 1st Battalion in Berlin again. And I was I was a captain, and I was very lucky because, in fact, I commanded each rifle company in turn, because majors and company commanders were coming and going a bit for some reason, and I had a turn at each rifle company and finished up with C Company. And I was commanding C Company when the Berlin Wall was built, and so we got involved there.
Had Berlin changed since the previous occasion.
Yes, oh yes. I mean, Berlin, when we were there, it was almost exactly 10 years before. Berlin in 1951 was still very much a bomb-ruined city, and they were busy clearing it up. 10 years later, in 61, certainly the western sector had been cleared up and rebuilt to some extent. The east was still in a bit of a state, and a bit, I mean, it was very noticeable crossing between west to east. Obviously some of it was psychological, but physically the buildings were drab and grey, and the people were drab and grey, whereas Berlin, West Berlin, of course, was a sort of showcase of the Western world, and anything that was good in the West tended to go to Berlin at some time or another, whether it was concerts or opera or exhibitions, whatever it was. But again, it was a good place to be. We enjoyed it very much. I then left the battalion in Berlin to do my first staff job, which was in West Germany, in headquarters 1st Division, which was in Verden. Again, I enjoyed that. Was my first, I was what was then called a G3 training, grade 3 staff officer training. We were very lucky. It was a happy headquarters. My immediate colleagues and superiors were all very friendly, nice people. And fairly soon after I'd arrived, we got a new general, who was General Miles Fitzalan Howard, who is now the Duke of Norfolk. And he turned up, and he was a great person. It was a very happy 2 years in Verden.
And were your responsibilities training, organising training?
Not organising it as such, but responsible for allocation of training areas, the allocation of ammunition. One of the best parts of the job, really, was being responsible for the courses run at the British Army Ski School in the Harz Mountains, which necessitated McBain making fairly regular visits to the Harz Mountains, summer and winter, which was good. So that was a pleasant aspect of the job. But the rest of it was very good. And I was very glad that I'd got that particular job. The man who shared my office with me, my colleague, he was what was known as a G3SD, staff duties. And he thought that was great, but I thought that was pretty boring. However, we were able to amuse ourselves. I then left there after 2 years. Yes, it was 2 years. And in fact, it was while I was there that I was told that I hadn't, although I'd passed the exam, I hadn't been selected for Staff College. This was a bit of a setback, a bit of a blow, because in those days, and still, the thought was that if you didn't go to Staff College, then you wouldn't make much progress in your military career.
On what grounds did they select then? If you passed an examination to go?
I think it was, I now know, but you see, I must have been a fairly airy-fairy sort of person, I think. I was just enjoying life, and I really wasn't too fussed about going to Staff College, other than the fact that somebody had said, boy, if you don't go to Staff College, you won't get very far. Okay. But it was obviously, I know now, that of course selection was based on your confidential report. Because everyone in the Army is subject to an annual confidential report. And unlike the Air Force, and I don't think the Navy do either, the Army, in fact, we did see our confidential report. And mine, you know, nobody had actually said McBain was a stinker, so that said it, I wasn't worried, you know, the fact that they weren't particularly glowing, I suppose. I should have been a bit more worried, but I wasn't. As I say, I was just enjoying life, and that was that.